Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to the K Thompson Live Show. I think that is Manchito and his orchestra. That's very cool Latin music. I am the son, Eric Payne, and this is the host you are.
K Thompson on K Thompson Live here, and welcome to the show tonight. We have a lot to cover. We are, you know, everybody's upset about, you know, the Eric Garner killing in New York City, and there are people still, you know, protesting, and you cannot really blame them because of the fact that the person who, the police people who, you know, had the man on the ground in Staten Island, you know, you could tell that he was couldn't breathe, and, you know, it was just absolutely ridiculous, and it's really very upset. And we were going to be talking attorney Ron Coogley tonight, but he is busy in New York with his case, because there's a whole lot of things in the media about it, and so we're going to get right to talking about it. Wayne Gilman is going to be on with us tonight, Eric, and he should be calling in very shortly, and we are really still very upset, especially with the whole Ferguson thing, and then the young man who, that was Michael Brown who was shot, the young boy who was shot by police, and this is outrageous. It's going all around the country. I don't blame the protesters. I'm glad they're out there, and I'm glad people are making their voices heard.
Yeah. It seems that to me, at least anyway, there's a situation where people are controlling the system. To me, and this is just my thoughts, they call it law and order, but it's not much law because these people aren't enforcing the law, because this guy used a chokehold, which is against protocol. So I'm wondering if him using that chokehold, which resulted in the death of Eric Garner, would be considered a crime. If that's the case, if it's the law that you're not supposed to use this chokehold, then he's breaking the law. If they're about law and order, they should enforce the law. But that all falls back to who is the person that's in charge of enforcing the law. Who is the person that's in charge of carrying these things out? That's why I say they're not really law and order, they're force and order, because they have the force and they just kind of bring some sort of order to things. But I'm wondering if they're really following the letter of the law, because clearly there seems to be some sort of problem with the fact that a police officer, you know, and just talk about basic fairness, this police officer can commit a crime, and these grand juries continue to come back with no verdict. I'm wondering what's lost in the translation of when the case goes before the grand jury. What gets lost in the translation? What common sense gets lost in what do you see on the videotape as opposed to what they get told when they go in the grand jury room to make them not decide in favor of what appears to be common sense. And I wonder if it's, you know, I look at the makeup of the grand jury, 23 people, 14 white, 9 non-white, 5 black. So, and you only need 12 for a decision. So that would mean that even if you break down the numbers, that even if you had all 9 non-white people of color sticking together, you still would need 3 white people to vote with them for a vote to go to a decision. And it makes me ask the question, or at least wonder, were there 3 white people out of that 14 that felt that Eric Garner, that the police officer did in fact violate the law when he put Eric Garner in a chokehold? And if not, then I wonder where the basic sense of fairness comes from. I don't want to assume that, you know, just because they're all white, they all thought one way. So I'm going to assume that probably was it could be any combination of breakdown in terms of the decision, number of people who voted for a decision, or they weren't able to get the whole 12 or whatever, or however it breaks down. But there seems to be a systematic problem. This keeps happening. Black men keep getting killed, and the system somehow, black men keep getting killed in their encounters with police officers, and somehow the system finds it okay, justifies the encounter, even times when it looks like the encounter on videotape was wrong, and this guy said he couldn't breathe, and nobody on the tape, as you can see, as far as I can see, even gave any credence to that, even reacted in kind of a manner to respond to the fact that he said he couldn't breathe. Even when the EMS people got there, they didn't seem to have any amount of urgency in them. So all of them seemed, even after the guy was on the ground, this particular officer had the full weight of his body with his hand and his knee on Eric Gardner's head. So there seems to be a systematic problem with who's enforcing the system, apparently. When it's the majority of one tribe, for lack of a better term, over another tribe, then maybe that tribe is going to favor their own the majority of the time. So maybe needs to happen within these systems, there needs to be more diversity, more black and brown and non-white people, and just a more diverse system within the law enforcement, within the Justice Department, within the prosecutor's office. Maybe then we can get some sort of justice, because it doesn't seem to be able to come any other way, unfortunately. And that's not to say, like I said, all, you know, white people think one way, but clearly the system needs to be more diverse.
Well, that's what it seems to be, really, I'm telling you, because the fact that the way law enforcement deals with the black community, namely young black males, not a lot of people in the black community or the Latino community and others don't trust white policemen anymore. That's obvious. Here you have a case of a young man selling cigarettes, and he dies for selling cigarettes. He was killed, and he was killed by the police members of the police department. And the policemen who were surrounding him at that particular time were white. Now, this has been happening all over the country, and that's why you see so much unrest with the community. And I think it's also involving people of other races, because the fact that they finally see the injustice of it, the injustice of it. You know, when you have a lot of blacks who are killed by white policemen around the country, you know, what are the kids thinking? The policemen are supposed to be there to protect the community, not to kill the community. The case of Ferguson with the white policeman Wilson. Here he shot this young man, and he shot him in the hands. Come on. And all of a sudden you hear certain things that just don't match with when we see on television, we're hearing from other people. So I really can't blame the protesters. Maybe the idea or the result is they should continue protesting in the streets and everywhere else until this is finally dealt with. Now we even have the President of the United States getting in on this, and now they're speaking tonight. And we're going to be recording on this next week, but this has got to stop. There are more black men arrested and in jail than there are white men. And it's not because of the crime is being committed by more, but more black men are being arrested. They're being put in jail, and they're not getting fair trials or even a fair shake, let's face it, you know. And you hate to say it by white policing, yes, but that's the reason. That's the fact. How can you look at the killing slash maybe murder of Eric Garner and think that it's a fair system? I don't understand that. We're seeing what happened. And then you get these reports by some people, you know, who are pro-policemen, you know, anything to, you know, sort of sanitize the policemen. The policemen a lot of times are wrong. They have been, the white police community, a lot of them, I'm not going to say all of them, but have been doing this to African-Americans for a long period of time. That's why you have these huge numbers of African-American men, Latino men, in jail more so than the whites that commit crime.
And, I'm sorry. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think that the history of the police force, from a historical context, coincides with the history of America. And at one time, racism, obviously slavery, and then legal racism, state-sanctioned racism, when Jim Crow and things were quite legal, and the way that was enforced was by the police force. And the police force was there to keep the order of the day. So I mean, it's just an extension of initially what was their original intention, was to keep people in order and to keep, at that time, was to protect the white society that was prevalent in America, and to make sure that the black and brown people were under control. And so as a result, here we are these years later, as soon as that culture to control a certain segment of the population, that perspective or that outlook that when a lot of these police officers are dealing with certain communities, particularly communities of color, there's a certain attitude that they seem to have, that they feel that they're keepers of the zoo or something like that. Excuse me, they said it even in Ferguson, you know, they caught some police officers calling some people animals and things like that. So there's a contempt for a lot of the times for the communities that they serve. And we want to get our other co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman, in here on this conversation. How are you today, Wayne, there in New York?
All right. Good evening, Kay. Good evening, Eric. Thank you, and forgive my tardiness. I was trying to physically come out there, but I'll have to wait for another night, you know.
Okay.
But I am so disgusted by today's news, you know. I really don't know what the cure is at this point. I mean, your mother and I have covered a number of cases like this over the years, you know, even before Abner Louima, and thank God our ingoing head of the Justice Department, Attorney General, will be at the helm overlooking the country's affairs as soon as Eric Holder retires, and she was largely responsible for, you know, prosecuting that case, Loretta Lynch. But I'm not surprised at the grand jury in Staten Island. I'm not surprised by Staten Island, period. But there is a lot that's just going on with the system, and the system is broken, and there needs to be some collective national effort to write changes like this, because, as I said last week, there is a symbiotic relationship between the local law enforcement, the local prosecutor. All these people know each other. They rub each other's shoulders. And I really question if there's ever going to be some independent factor. You know, I don't want to condemn that maybe a special prosecutor couldn't solve this, but it definitely has to be on a federal level. And all afternoon I've been, you know, channel surfing, and everyone of progressive thinking has the same opinion. You know, it's just sad what goes on here.
You know, there's a question that really has to be asked, Wayne and Eric, and that is, why are black youth killed by policemen around the country in large numbers? Why? This has been going on ever since I've been conscious, you know? And yes, and white people, black, seven times more, they are stopped, and 11 times more, I'm looking at some statistics here, they are there to be arrested. And then incarcerated, getting longer sentences. It's incredible. You know, you go on year after year after year with the same kind of nonsense. You know, it just doesn't make sense. You know? And is the answer for police to have body cameras, is that really going to do some good? I hope so. But the point is, my police officers, you know, they, I don't know what's wrong with them. Are they really basically racist? You know,
well, I mean that's a tough call, Kate. There's got to be a need for behavior modification. There's something about the culture, but you know, even with these body cameras, I mean, here we had a video of this incident in Staten Island. Unlike Ferguson, you know, we just have to leave it as a matter of opinion of who saw what and what witnesses came forward to testify out there in Ferguson. But, you know, we saw this in live, living color. I mean, it's been repeated over and over again. This guy, the guy who even did the chokehold or hold down, whatever Patrick Lynch of the Police Benevolent Association wants to call it, the fact of the matter is, we saw where this guy, after the incident, was joking and almost in a cavalier manner, acting like as if, well, big deal, I'm going to get off anyway because I'm a cop. You know, that's what his body language said. And the thing is that it just saddens me. It's easy to come back a month or two later and sound contrite and apologetic and mournful, to, you know, about what goes on. But a life is lost, and this has been, as you said, Kay, has been going on way too long. There's a part of me that wants to believe that people don't automatically sign up for this kind of work and immediately have harbor racist feelings. But it just seems that the stats show that there is a preponderance of more of what you don't expect than there is of rightful jurisprudence going on, and which brings me to the whole Charles Barkley conversation. I don't know if Eric had a chance to see what Barkley had to say about that.
Before we get into that, I just wanted to comment real quickly on what you said about some of these cops and culture. I think, and whether this guy was racist, this guy, the cop who choked Eric Garner, I think that a lot of these guys, they stopped him because he was black. They stopped him because he was a black dude in the area and he was doing these things. And I think their culture is, they do have a certain contempt for a certain type of black people, the black people that they run into on the job when they're doing their police work. And maybe their contempt might extend out of some prejudice or some kind of racial outlook on life from them growing up, part of their culture. I wouldn't be surprised at all. You know, some of these guys grow up using the N-word and things like that. I don't know whether he specifically stopped Eric Garner because he was black, but because they carry this contempt for black people, particularly in, you know, the hood or wherever they work in these communities where these police officers work, I think that they think they're going to get away with things and there's not going to be any consequences. So therefore, they do things like put chokeholds on cats and abuse people because they carry this contempt just inherently when they come to the job, I think. Some of them, at least anyway. It's clear.
I agree with you on that level. I mean, the thing is that I had a situation where somebody who was a recent graduate from a local Catholic college here in Westchester County, happened to be the boyfriend of a tenant of mine, and he was trying to get into the criminal justice system, and he was complaining. This is not a person of color. This is somebody who migrated from New Jersey to come to attend school, graduated with flying colors, was looking to join the NYPD, and, you know, was able to get a foothold in the organization, but was complaining that he could not get hired because his number, I guess there's some sort of, I forgive the expression, caste system in which people are called in to join the ranks of the training at police headquarters. So the deal is he was complaining about how he couldn't find work. And then he was, you know, talking about how, you know, people of color have these special programs to go into, and somehow they get hired a lot faster than people like himself. And I brought it up to your mother's attention over the summer. I don't know, Kay, if you remember this, about 6 months ago, and you were telling me about how, even in his home state of New Jersey, they were looking for people, regardless of what nationality, trying to find work in an environment, you know, where jobs were hard to come by. And I know you gave me the information. I decided, because I wanted to prove a point to this person about this whole issue about, you know, favoritism and what goes on in the system. But the fact of the matter is that if we didn't have programs, you know, like what came out of the 60s and the 50s with the civil rights movement and all the angst and the aggravation and the destruction that occurred there, you know, the opportunities that this kid was complaining about that was extended to us wouldn't even be. It would still be the same Wild West mentality that you see in Ferguson and some of these other places outside of the Northeast and even the West, for that matter, you know, because I still maintain what goes on in the center of the United States is totally, not consistent with what you find in larger communities. And even here, with all of the talk of liberalism and there being a blue state, you still have situations like what happened in Staten Island. You have the Abner Louima stories. I could just go on and on, and it's just despicable. But I don't know what the answer is. And then,
Go ahead, Ray.
I'm sorry. You have prominent people, educated people, people who have traveled and people of means like the Charles Barkleys. And I understand to a certain extent what he means, that we need to clean up our own act. It does bother me. But I can't, blatantly just turn around and say that there isn't a sickness within the system where certain people are hired to come with their preconceived notions predicated on either childhood or familial experiences or what their parents may think, and they may not have an open mind. And it's just hard. And there's got to be some way to weed these people out in the training process. They should not be allowed to police our streets.
Wayne, do you know anything? There's no excuse. There's absolutely no excuse for someone to be selling cigarettes on the street to have to die for it. Okay?
No, I understand that.
Right, they just happen to be white, but this happens all around the country. In just about every single state, in the United States, you are going to find this, and basically it comes from slavery, so let's face it. You hear it over and over and over again. As a matter of fact, we know that the jails are so full of Black and Latino that this is big business. And I think that probably what's going to be happening is that people are going to find out that this business is owned a lot of the stock. There must be stock in prisons, because it's making a whole lot of people a whole lot of money, especially if they're privately owned.
Right.
So I think people insured should look into that. But I'll tell you another thing that really I got kind of tickled with, because the New York Police Department, they were really very concerned because of the fact that the activists, the anarchists, were using the social media and online bulletin boards to keep ahead of what the city cops were doing. And that's how they were creating so much mayhem about where they were going to be and where they were going to, demonstrate and whatnot. And they won the game of what they call whack-a-mole. I'm looking in the New York paper right now. I don't know if it's the Daily News or whatever, but I got really very amused with it because they clearly won this whole game. They were shutting down major roads, I'm understanding, including the FDR Drive, Lincoln Tunnel, and the West Side Highway, and they were frustrating the NYPD.
And they were doing this as a part of the Ferguson protest, to tie it into Eric Garner that we're talking about now, and I guess who knows what they have in store next now with this breaking news that we're talking about.
That's right. And then with the president getting involved, and Eric Holder, I can't wait until the late news.
Eric Holder, the Attorney General.
The Attorney General, right, after the president. And I can't wait to hear what they were talking about, because I don't understand what kind of programs or what kind of legislation you can set in place to really stop this, because this is tearing the country apart. It really is. There are so many young African men being arrested for minor things. I'm not talking about those who are, dealing with heavy duty stuff and drugs and all that sort of thing. Some of them should be in there. But to the number 11 times more or certain percentages higher than your white, people who are doing the same thing.
And I see that we're joined by Congressman Payne, Congressman Donald Payne Jr. Congressman, we saw earlier. Well, first, welcome. Thanks for calling in tonight. Talk about the grand jury decision. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you.
Congressman Payne, how are you? Glad to have you on.
Your New York colleagues hold their press conference and express their views about how they felt about the grand jury decision tonight. Do you? What's your feeling, and what's their response to you and your discussions?
Well, as I contemplated coming on tonight, So many things have been going through my mind in terms of what we've witnessed over the past week. It was just a week ago that I was on your show and we were talking about the grand jury in Ferguson, and now here we are 7 days later, and we're still talking about the same thing, a grand jury in another part of the country, Staten Island, that just could not find their way in holding a police officer accountable for his actions. And in Ferguson, you had to rely on eyewitness testimony. But here, we had the videotaping of it. And it just strikes me as, you know, I went to the floor today and, you know, made my feelings known on Ferguson. I was not able to join the Black Caucus on Monday at the special order. So I went to the floor today, and I asked Mr. Speaker, I said, "Mr. Speaker, hands up, don't shoot." And I went from there, and some of my colleagues felt that was fairly provocative to invoke the speaker's name as I said it, but I did it for a reason. We might as well forget. And the point I was trying to make was, I spoke about, money that's going to be made available for video cameras. Now, this was at noon. Well, guess what? Here it is after 8 on the East Coast, and we might as well forget about video cameras because it's not going to make any difference, obviously, because this was videotaped. So now what difference is it going to matter that police have cameras attached to their vests? It's not going to mean anything because a grand jury was convinced today by someone that you're not really seeing. Don't use your eyes. Let us tell you what happened. What you're watching is not really happening. This officer did not kill this man with an illegal chokehold. I know that's what it looks like, but here, let us give you the reasons why that's not what you're seeing. It is absolutely absurd, and I am just fit to be tied. You know, as I was thinking about it again, you know, how profound now is Spike Lee and Do the Right Thing? I was sitting here in my car, and I thought about the scene that invokes the violence in the community was of a police officer choking a man in a chokehold.
Yeah.
Now, am I right? Am I right, Eric?
Exactly. You're absolutely right.
So here we are, 25 years. How old is that movie? 20 years old?
At least 20 years
here
old.
We are. Here we are watching exactly what transpired on Staten Island in July. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely unfathomable.
Yeah. Mhm. Mhm. The anger that you feel, you know, for instance, the anger that I feel, you know, it's incredible. It's really almost hard to contain. And, you know, there's another thing you may want to be, you know, I was reading I think it was Starlight the other day. I'm looking at the military weapons that have gone on, that are in the police department, you know. And I said, what the heck? We have a whole list of military weapons, you know, I guess the government gives away or
surplus weapons.
And it says here that the police agencies nationwide have long had access to a trove of surplus military gear given away by the Pentagon, everything from unwanted office computers and secure furniture to machine guns and grenade launchers. And then it gives you a whole list of, you know, the different cities in New Jersey, Congressman, who, you know, have gotten assault rifles, have gotten all kinds of things. And then State Senator Nia Kill pushed for the lease for the information, and she questioned the need of such of these these weapons that are going to our arsenal. And some of those cities, the Jersey City, Mount Olive Township, Patterson, Belleville, West New York, Stratford, Jackson, Lakewood, Elizabeth, and it goes on and on and on. And then they gave a list of, you know, the amount of money that was spent in this total equipment that, you know, it was released by the New Jersey Attorney General's office. It shows one was the $51.9 million in surplus military equipment, and it went to New Jersey Police Department. And the top recipients, they have a whole list of all ones from, I guess, about 20 different towns, from Plainfield to Jackson to Manalapan to Perth Amboy, Union Beach, Marlboro, Seagrave, Red Bank, Brick Township, Adams Township, and on and on. This is some dangerous stuff. This is a dangerous time.
Let me ask you about what you guys can do at the federal level addressing just that, the militarization of a lot of police forces in the country.
Well, we have addressed it over the past several months when this whole incident in Ferguson took place where, you know, you had police officers in paramilitary gear trained at protesters. We raised the issue in the House of Representatives, and we're looking at that whole issue now. There was a vote taken in the Congress in the past. I would say it was September, October, in reference to this gear, and it's a whole new issue that we're all looking at in response to what we saw horrified. And let me just say, up to this point, and the reason that that equipment was given to the police departments, you know, since 9/11 with the terrorist attacks, there had been a feeling that in certain instances, this equipment would be helpful to police departments. If you have a standoff with a man with a gun in a tower, or if you have a situation where you have your terrorist barricaded in an apartment building, or whatever the circumstance may be, this was never intended use was against American citizens.
Right.
That was never the intended use of it. It was for SWAT teams, for emergency rescue teams, for, you know, elite-type, SWAT-type instances where you had. So it was never for use against, peaceful volunteers and to have protesters and to have guns trained on them as they were with the sniper just waiting, you know, in his earpiece to get the call to fire, you know, was never this intent. So we've had to re-look and reevaluate the whole deployment of that type of equipment in police departments.
Yeah, because, you know, it's really very frightening to see the National Guard come in, you know, fully, you know, with the weapons that they need, of course. But that is some scary kind of stuff. You know, here people are demonstrating, and you bring in the armed forces, you know, with all kinds of assault weapons. What the hell is going on in this world? I don't even know how to even talk about it as much. You know, it is such an emotional thing, because to think that my grandchildren are going to have to be dealing with this, what kind of sense does this make?
Not much.
Yeah. So what's the stance with the president? You know, I didn't hear his speech. So what kind of what was he saying, Congressman?
Well, the president, you know, we've been very pleased with his the statements he's been making. He had a conference on the American Native Americans today. And he took time before he started his comments to them in reference to their issues about what transpired today and what has happened over the last week. He had just gotten off the phone with Eric Holder and, you know, made a statement that, you know, that we're very pleased with you know, in on no certain terms that this should be tolerated in this nation, and that people at least need to feel that the system works equally for every American and not just a select few.
Yeah.
So I was very pleased with his statement today, and he naturally has had Mr. Holder engage right away. I believe before I came on, I watched his statement on what has transpired, and they will be doing a full investigation on, you know, human rights, civil rights violations in this case. So he was very quick to respond, and, you know, I get a sense that he is getting fed up with this as well, so which is a good sign.
So the course of action that can be taken when you have some of these cases going on where the grand jury of these various communities obviously seems to believe something else happened, and it seems to be such a travesty of justice in certain cases, the Mike Brown case, this case. What is the next course of action that can be taken? That could be taken in a lot of these, in some of these cases, in terms of from a legislative standpoint. I guess it would be the Attorney General. Is that correct?
Yeah, the Attorney General is going to start an investigation here in New York. He still has two federal investigations into Ferguson. And, you know, that's really the next course of action, and to wait to see what the Attorney General comes back with, what his recommendations are, and move forward from there. And based on that information, you know, we can kind of start drafting legislation that will, you know, go towards remedying this. But you have to remember too, we're in the minority party in the House, in both houses, and don't know how far, you know, we will be able to get legislatively if you know, our colleagues on the other side of the aisle don't see things the way that we do. So it's a challenge, but we're up for the challenge, and had a very spirited meeting today. In the Congressional Black Caucus, we meet every Wednesday at noon to discuss topics and issues and legislation that are before us and important to us. And there was a lot of passion in the room about doing something, you know, in a positive manner. And I think you're going to see a movement and an effort by the Congressional Black Caucus that you've never seen before. I can't really talk about it, but committed to do what we need to do as the elected leaders by our constituents and being the conscience of the Congress, as we're called. We need to step up, and we believe that, and we feel that. But, you know, in their defense, I heard a few commentators over the past week asking where was the Black Caucus. And we've been here the whole time, and we've been dealing with these issues. But, you know, we also defer to the members from those congressional districts on how they want us to proceed in their district. And so, you know, we have to be mindful of that there is a sitting member in the district, and we try to acquiesce to their wishes. But I think the feeling today was in some of these cases, you know, it's our obligation to move forward, and that's what we're going to do. So I think you're going to see a very spirited round of engagement by the Congressional Black Caucus in Ferguson, in New York, and wherever else we're called on.
Okay.
As Wayne, as the member or the host from New York, Wayne, do you have some questions as it relates to?
Right. Thank you, Eric, and good evening, Congressman. I have to agree with a lot of what you said. My only problem is I'm not really comfortable with the whole grand jury process anymore. It just doesn't seem to be working. Maybe it's the people who are called. But I just think on a local level, maybe there could be an effort made for a departmental investigation to have this cop fired. You know, I mean, there's no reason why somebody, based on what we saw on camera, should be walking the streets, patrolling our streets, you know, and that's something that New Yorkers can do, or at least there should be some sort of campaign to see to it that an investigation is conducted, because, you know, here it is, you know, we got the grand jury with their no bill. Of course, if we have a special prosecutor, the outcome might be a little different. But, you know, we've just seen too many times where cases like this, cops really get indicted and brought up on charges, you know. And the
right.
PBA, forget about it. You know, it's like they have their own preconceived notion. They don't want to call it a chokehold. They call it a holdout. You know, what's the difference? This man was calling to have his life spared, and that was that. But it's a tough call.
Well, you know, Wayne, in this situation and circumstance, you know, Ferguson, Missouri is one drop back, but Staten Island and the city of New York and the state of New York is another drop back. I commend both the mayor of the city of New York, who has called for an investigation, and also your governor. I don't know if you've heard, but in the last hour, has called for a federal investigation. So,
no,
you
I didn't
know,
hear that.
Yeah. Governor Cuomo has called for a thorough federal investigation. So, you know, you have the government pretty much aligned on the same side, saying that you know, something is wrong here. So, I mean, you're really two steps ahead of the game, as opposed to what they're dealing with in Ferguson. But to your point about grand juries, and, you know, do you know how you get chosen for a grand jury?
Well, I know there's a selection process.
It's by your voter registration.
Exactly.
If you're registered to vote, then they call you to serve on juries. So if the young people out there were registered to vote, more of them would be called in these circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yes, it's important to vote, but it impacts so many other issues and places where we can find some justice if the right people are asked the questions. But because we feel it's not important to be registered, then we don't get chosen for those juries, and these things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that is something that we have to be mindful of. So, I, you know, I'm just saying that I don't know the outcome of what the investigations will find, but I think it's good that you had the mayor who made an impassioned speech. No one wrote that. That was from his heart. That was about his son. That was about his daughter. That was about his wife. So he lives it, so he understands it, and he doesn't want it to happen to his son. So his speech was impassioned, and it wasn't written. And I commend the governor for stepping in as quickly as he has as well. So hopefully, Wayne, we can, you know, in New York, we'll find a different path to justice than the discouragement the people out in Missouri have found.
You know what?
I
would like to see more done with kids in high school, okay? Starting with kids in high school, have them form political groups and discuss the politics of the country. Discuss how they can be involved with, you know, government and become involved and run for office and make sure that they have these issues. I know the Y used to do this, and I don't even know what happened to that. Maybe, you know, it's happening and, you know, I'm just not aware of it. But, you know, politics is very, we have to get more people involved with what government does and what they can do and what is the power of the people. So if we have that in open forums and with, you know, kids in high school, some of those high school kids are pretty doggone bright. So they'll understand being involved. So involve them from a very young age.
Well, and certainly your point about how people get chosen for a grand jury is an interesting kind of a 360 about how, if you look at kind of the situation of Ferguson and the grand jury making the decision that it made, I don't know if you actually, you know, there's other issues with that particular decision, but it's just interesting, you know, when you talked when the statistics came out about the percentage of people that went out to vote in Ferguson, and it showed that their statistics were way below the average, and the fact that they end up then with a majority power structure in the city government that doesn't reflect the diversity of the community. It all is really tied together, and it's interesting that you brought up the point about the grand jury. You have to register to vote because we see how that lack of being registered to vote affected people, even to the point of the type of people that would appoint the people who would be on the police force, and that would be the city council would have some effect of that. So it is really an interesting tie-in and how it's all connected.
I just want to chime in that. If you don't mind, I think it's important that all of us are registered, but I think it's also equally important that we educate ourselves about the issues at hand. It's one thing to fill out a registration form and be selected, but very often a lot of people, you know, I've even served on federal juries, and I'm amazed at the sea of ignorance. You know, when they go through the challenges of excluding and weeding who serves and who won't serve in the course of a trial. Of course, in a grand jury situation, it's a lot different and it's secretive, but there's something about that process that's got to change. I don't know if it should be out in the open. You know, I don't know what it is, but the officer had a chance to tell his side of the story, and somehow the people that were sitting in that panel fell for it. They just had open sympathy without looking at the facts.
Right. Well, we know the makeup of the 90% of the makeup of Staten Island. Someone on the show today made an interesting point. No, actually, it was one of the members of the New York delegation. He said he wasn't surprised by it because half of the police officers that work for the city of New York live in Staten Island. That's where they live.
Exactly.
So it's a community of police officers out there. So it's your the guy is someone's neighbor. Yeah, he's a New York cop, but he lives in Staten Island, and the ones that work in Manhattan, Queens, and the other boroughs predominantly live in Staten Island. So, you know, that's another hurdle that had to be overcome here. It's just an interesting thing. And back to Ferguson for a minute. And, you know, Eric, that was the point, really. 12%, less than 12% of the African-American population, which is 80% of Ferguson, is registered. So if 80%, if 100%, nothing's ever going to be 100%, say 80% of that population registered, guess what? They pick the mayor, police chief. Okay? So if there was participation on electoral level, they pick the council people who approve the police chief. If you don't have a mayor and someone that you don't want to be the police chief, if you have the majority of the council, that person can't become police chief because they get advice and consent.
That's true.
So let's start with the basics. Let's get people registered.
Yeah.
And you know, and then the education can come. But let's at least get them on the books, because just imagine if all of those people that are irate in Ferguson now were registered. What they could do, they could get rid of that mayor, that police, they could get rid of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, they don't have any power. They don't have any power.
Salient point. Very salient.
You know, I remember the organization of black policemen in New York called the Guardians. Are they still in existence, Wayne?
Yes, they are. And they've been vocal on this too. I mean, they were at the forefront at the very beginning, and I didn't see anyone from the organization from some of the coverage that I've watched today. But I know that all of them are in lockstep with de Blasio with respect to what's going on. And they've been very vocal about the internal struggles within the NYPD, because not everybody approves of the police commissioner and some of the things that he's been doing. The only thing the city seems everywhere everyone is in agreement was getting rid of the stop and frisk, and you know that. But that's about the extent of it. I mean, it's not to say that the police commissioner Braddon is not trying to make an effort, but for some reason there still seems to be that color line problem. You know, where we only reach a certain ceiling and the bar is never, you know, raised, or the ceiling is never raised above that to have an equal distribution in terms of involvement. And let's face it, this city is more a city of color than it is, you know, of what one would think is being the majority. You know, when you look at New York City, I mean, Manhattan specifically and Staten Island, those are the boroughs which I think with the largest concentration of whites. But you look at the topography of everything else in terms of demographics. You know, I'm not saying that there aren't pockets in which, you know, these communities that don't have predominantly other white sections, but the vast majority, you know, you have Asians, you have Latinos, you have blacks, and every other nationality that figures in terms of the color scheme. So, you know, it's time for change, and maybe with some of the progress that's going on here, maybe it will, you know, find its way across the country, but something needs to be done. You know, I'm afraid to travel, to be honest with you. If I were in a situation where I had to drive from state to state, anything west of Oklahoma, I'd be scared. You know, I mean, it's just too much nonsense, and Texas, forget about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Just one of those things.
Yeah, I mean, culturally, from a cultural standpoint, I for me, think it's the system and the lack of diversity within the system. You know, the more you have a diverse infrastructure, so to speak, and people that are going to be making that infrastructure function, the better it's going to be. And not just infrastructure in terms of making the wheels turn, but infrastructure in terms of establishing policy and enforcement and things like that to truly have a fair system, because we don't really have justice now. We have a law, I guess, law and order, or like I was saying before, force and order. People that are forcing people to follow these laws. But what seems to happen is that people get in control and they change the laws to reflect their own personal beliefs. And a lot of times these laws, as we're beginning to find out, aren't just laws. They're laws that seem to systematically hurt a particular group or section of the population. And in these times, that's when, you know, the whole system needs to be questioned and looked at again, because they're using this system to oppress the people, you know. As I go back to what I was saying before, initially, you know, law and order, they were suppressing black people, keeping slaves in order. There's still remnants in this system of that. There's still remnants of it being majority kind of force of white individuals that are the majority of police officers. And so there might be still some of that culture left over. And that goes beyond and breaks the law in many instances in terms of not enforcing the law to make sure people's civil rights aren't violated and people aren't being treated fairly across the board and they're not being discriminated against. And when you have individuals that are supposed to be representatives of the law, claim to be representative of the law, and they're not enforcing the law, but in fact breaking the law, and they can still remain in power and remain a part of that system, then clearly the system needs to be to be changed and questioned. And certainly when you have a system that there lends itself to the area of collusion, because clearly in the prosecutor's office, they need to have help or at least cooperation with the police. So it seems that there is some sort of, you know, watch our back, we'll take care of our guys. So we're coming up close to the end of the show, about the last 3 minutes. I don't know if, Congressman, maybe you have some final closing thoughts about where we are with the situation of these two cases in America now.
Well, it's very disturbing. I hearken back to our childhoods where, we've been exposed to some of this, in our lifetime and been in some circumstances that just should not have been, then only because of the color of our skin did we find ourselves in that circumstance. And it's unfortunate that, I have two 16-year-old boys now, and, I'm going to have to teach them how, if they're approached by a police officer. Even now, still, when I'm approached by an officer in my car, once I park, I put my hands up over the steering wheel on the dashboard flat so they can see them. And, I'm going to have to teach my boys that same procedure, because I don't know what it is that people being so frightened of African Americans that anytime they find themselves in a circumstance, they feel they have to kill them.
Yeah.
But that's where we are. Yeah. That's where we are in this country. I watched a video today of a person in a park in San Diego, and he went to his car and got a gun. Police were already in the park because he was acting, had some issues. So the police were already there with their guns drawn. He goes back to his car and gets a gun and starts waving it around. He points it at the helicopter. No shot. He keeps pointing at them and waving it. Finally, they take him down with one shot. One shot. And then seven of them move in to pick the guy up. And the next thing you see, he's in an ambulance going to the hospital. Why did Michael Ferguson need 12 shots in his body?
We're going to have to put an end in it right there, Congressman. That's a great perspective. And something that we definitely have to think about on the Kay Thompson Live Show. I want to thank our other co-host, Wayne Gilman. Wayne, thanks for
it.
For
thank
being
you.
With us.
And I would have been there. You know, I was afraid of the demonstrations because I'd have to go through that to get to you. But
okay.
Thanks again.
All right. Thank you, Wayne. I'm Eric Payne. Thanks, Congressman Donald Payne, for being on the show with us. I'm Eric Payne, the son, and you are
Kay Thompson. Join us there next week
on the Kay Thompson Live Show. Here on the GoPro Radio Network, on the Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Kay Thompson Live. Join us again next week. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.